Well, good evening.
Good evening.
Good evening. I mentioned this morning that it was not intentional for both of our lessons to be sets of twos. It's just the way it worked out. And in thinking about giving a lesson, I thought about the fact I don't think I've ever preached a lesson on this subject. It comes up in passing when you're discussing the crucifixion, particularly in Luke's account with Herod, Jesus being sent to Herod from Pilate. But other than that, I don't think I'd ever sat down and really studied these two different trials. So we're going to take a look tonight at two trials before Herod, one involving Jesus and one involving Paul. And of all the Herods that are in the New Testament, we're only going to talk about one of them, and that is no small feat. If you've got a Bible dictionary at home or you've ever looked up how many Herods are there, there are a ton. The name Herod was not a first name. It was more of a title. And we know the first Herod we run into in our New Testaments is Herod the Great. This is the Herod that kills the baby boys at two and under in Bethlehem as he's trying to extinguish the life of Jesus. Now, historically, not biblically, but historically, he's called Herod the Great for a reason. Of all the Herods, he was the only one who could really truly be called a king. He ruled over what is most of modern-day Palestine, most of the Bible lands of the time, over Judea and over Galilee. And he was historically, even though he's a cruel man as far as the Bible is concerned, and all these guys were cruel, any Roman governor, any Roman official back during this time was most certainly incestuous, sexually debauched, drunken, and evil by our standards. So Herod the Great was no different. Herod Archelaus, if you remember when Jesus is brought back from Egypt, Herod's descendant is on the throne. That's why Joseph and Mary go up into Galilee to live. Herod Philip is mentioned just one time in the Bible. Herod Antipas, this is the Herod before whom Jesus' trial is had. This is also the Herod that cut off the head of John the Baptist. Herod Agrippa, you remember from the book of Acts, does not give glory to God and is struck down and eaten with worms. He is the one who killed the Apostle James, and Herod Agrippa II. So of all the Herods on that list, tonight it's going to be Herod Antipas and Herod Agrippa II. Whew! If you think that's complicated, you should start looking at all the branches and the footnotes of the different daughters, wives, aunts, cousins that all were married in this family. It is quite the combination. That's putting it, that's probably about as mild as it's ever been put to say that Herod's had a relatively interesting family, but he did. So tonight we're going to talk about two kings who were called king who were not really king. Herod Antipas is referred to as king. He's basically a governor over a territory, and Agrippa II is even less so. He's a tetrarch, which is even a lower class of government official. These men were Edomites. I don't know if you remember your Old Testament quickly enough to remember whose descendants those are. Those are Esau's descendants. And the Bible tells us that the descendants of Esau would always be trouble for the descendants of Jacob, for Israel. So these men are not Jews. They are Idumean, or they are Edomites, and they submit to circumcision, and they rule over Israel. So Israel, that laughingly tells Jesus at one time, we have never had anyone but Abraham over us, had Romans and uncircumcised half-Jews at the same time. So that's who these people are, and they are who we're going to be dealing with today as the government meets the church. The government meets the church. And the first thing to be pointed out about both Jesus and Paul is this: they are declared to have no fault. Now, I must tell you right off the bat, some of this discussion is going to veer into Pilate. You can't get away, you can't really deal with Herod Antipas' trial of Jesus in Luke 23 without also dealing with Pilate. In fact, it was Pilate who said to the chief priests and the crowds, I find no guilt in this man. In fact, it's that very not finding of guilt that led Pilate to send Jesus to Herod Antipas. In Acts chapter 23, Paul is in jail. And in Acts, Paul had been thrown in jail basically because he had preached to the Gentiles and the Jews just didn't want to hear that. And a man named Festus says this in Acts 23:29. I found that he was being accused about questions of their law. This is in a letter he's writing. but charged with nothing deserving death or imprisonment. Let's just think about this for just a moment. Paul is going to be sent to Rome. He's in jail for several years. Jesus is on trial that will end in his death. Yet the Roman officials dealing with both these men said what? Not guilty. No charge, no blame. And I tell you what that made me think about. And in the last few years, as you know, we have one visitor tonight, maybe some that don't know. We installed elders last year. We're very excited about that. And in doing so, it was a many-year process of studying, teaching, and doing those things. And one of the words that you come across there in 1 Timothy chapter 3 is this word blameless. Blameless, and that can be taken to an extreme that no man can meet, right? That's the one qualification. You can always unqualify somebody if you really just want to do that. Not that anyone has ever done that, but it might happen eventually. But the idea of blameless, when you dig into it and you're researching it for a long time, the phrase not chargeable could not be have a charge brought against. A man who is blameless is not a man who has no sin. He's a man who has no open charge. He's not wanted. He's not an open bank robber. He's not someone that has theft in his background. He's not someone who has adult who's active in adultery. Anything that he has gotten in his life, he may have sin, and we all do, but at the moment, he is blameless. He does not have an open charge against him. So when I could not help but reading these circumstances that both of these men, Jesus and Paul, are the same man. They are without charge. The Roman government could charge them with anything they wanted, and they could find no charge. In fact, this letter written here, Claudius Lysias writes, he's writing it to a man. He's sending Paul just because he had to protect Paul from the Jews around him, and he doesn't really know what to say. So he says, but charged with nothing deserving death or imprisonment. And even as we go from Felix to Festus, and I started to run that down for you, and I thought if I hadn't confused you enough, I would by then. Look at Acts chapter 25. Acts chapter 25. This is Festus, and this is not Festus the gunsmoke guy, because I when I was a kid and they talked about Festus, I just giggled, and you know, because I did that, right? We all know the deal. But Festus is a Roman official, and he's the second Roman official to write about Paul's guiltiness, his blamefulness or blamelessness. Acts 25 and verse 25. Acts 25, and I apologize. Acts chapter 25, verse 25 reads like this. But I have nothing definite to write to my Lord about him. Therefore, I have brought him before you all, and especially before you, King Agrippa, so that after we have examined him, I may have something to write. For it seems to me unreasonable in sending a prisoner not to indicate the charges against him. This, think about this for just a minute. Festus is a Roman official. He has this prisoner. He has to do something with him. Paul has appealed to Caesar, so he has to send him to Caesar. And you know what his charge is? Oh, Caesar, I'm sending this prisoner. I'm interrupting your time so that this Roman citizen can come stand before you. And why? Because reasons. He's got nothing. So he asks Herod Agrippa II, who's his main subjects? These are the Jews. This is the Idumean Edomite who is a tetrarch in the Jewish region. So he thinks maybe he'll know something that I can bring a charge for. And that's how we end up in Paul's part of these two trials. We know about Jesus before Herod Antipas. We're going to learn about Paul before Herod Agrippa II. So these two men had no reason to be brought to trial. Both are guiltless. Jesus will be condemned. Paul will eventually be sent to Caesar. But, and here's where I get back on track. Were they respectful of authority? Yes. Yes. Scott sang a great song for this lesson. I don't know if he knew it or not. But 10,000 angels. Jesus did not have to put up with his foolishness. He didn't have to be mocked and spit upon by the Jewish authorities. And he didn't have to be put to death by the Roman ones. If there was anyone who had the right to disobey, it was Jesus, sinless, blameless, the creator of the very human beings and the very governments and the very kingdoms that were going to convict him. Yet, Jesus was submissive. Now we use that word a lot when we're talking about husbands and wives and submitting and worship and those things. And boy, that word in our modern times just makes people kind of curl up inside. But let me tell you something. Jesus submitted, and praise his name, he did. Paul submitted. And guess what our role is before the federal government? To submit. Now I'm telling you, that's not the message you're going to get from the outside world. But that's what Jesus did. Look in John 18. John 18 says this, and here he's referring to Pilate, not Herod. Jesus answered, "My kingdom is not of this world. If my kingdom were of this world, my servants would have been fighting, but that I might not be delivered over to the Jews. But my kingdom is not from the world." Do you know why Jesus didn't try to debunk what Pilate was doing? Because he did not come here to mess with something as trivial as the Roman Empire. Jesus was not here to establish something that would only last 500-600 years. Jesus was not here over a mere human kingdom or mere human rules or mere human right or wrong. He was here to establish the kingdom of God. And that's a spiritual kingdom. Jesus was not here to take over Palestine, to take over Judea. If he had wanted to do that, he could have done that. If he had wanted to take over the entire Fertile Crescent, the whole Mediterranean Sea, Western Europe and Northern Africa and all these areas, Jesus could have done that. But it wasn't why he was here. God has established two realms in which Christians need to submit. The spiritual, which we talk about all the time, right? If I confess Jesus is Lord and believe in my heart that God raised him from the dead, I will be saved. That's submission. So it's saying to God, not my will, but yours be done. And within the government, it is God who has established governments. Well, you might say, well, they do things wrong. Well, they did things wrong to Jesus. And he had the power to change it, to call 10,000 angels, as the song said. But he submitted. Listen to what Paul says here. Now, admittedly, you have to understand this is a legal proceeding, and Paul is buttering up his accusers a little bit here. But notice the respect that Paul pays. Acts 26 and 2, and I have my screen in the right place. That's always nice. "I consider myself fortunate that it is before you, King Agrippa, I'm going to make my defense today against all the accusations of the Jews, especially because you are familiar with all the customs and controversies of the Jews. Therefore, I beg you to listen to me patiently." Both Jesus and Paul did their citizenship duty. They did what they were supposed to do as Roman citizens, as people who were under Rome. They obeyed the government. Well, guess what? We're to strive to be blameless, especially if we want to be considered mature enough to become shepherds in the congregation, and all Christians should want to head toward that maturity. We want to be blameless, but we also want to respect authority as Jesus and Paul did. Romans chapter 13 and verse 1. Let me turn over there for just a second. Romans chapter 13 and verse 1. And we're actually going to deal with two passages. And so many people say, well, the government's crooked. The government does this. The government does that. Do you know who was emperor when Paul wrote this? Nero. I don't care how corrupt you think whatever government is you're trying to disobey. The words of God say that we are to obey the government. Now, there is the caveat, of course, that Peter said, you decide for yourselves whether we should obey God or man. But as long as it doesn't involve us sinning against God, we are to submit. Romans 13, 1. "Let every person be subject to the governing authorities, for there is no authority except from God. And those that exist have been instituted by God." God literally has, in the realm of the Israelite, from the time of Sinai until the Babylonian captivity, God had a people who were both religious and civil. Not necessarily nice to each other, but they had religion and the government tied up in one thing. That's why when you read the Law of Moses, you get into all these seeming to us tedious little verses about this particular sacrifice and this particular sin and this particular deal. That's because God was giving the people of Israel a book of legal precedent. And don't those words put you to sleep just right? Can't you imagine the joy of looking into a book of legal precedent? And that's why, frankly, some of Exodus and Deuteronomy is that way. But come the time of Christ, the civil and the religious are separate. we're not trying to take over the land of Canaan. We're not trying to take over the land of flowing with milk and honey. We're not trying to keep a physical ethnic group of people together. You want to be a Christian? Come on in. You want to be a part of this kingdom? Come on in. It's not physical, it's spiritual. And we don't fight physical battles to win spiritual warfare. So Romans 1 says, God instituted the physical governments, we're to be subject to them. 1 Peter chapter 2, verse 13. 1 Peter chapter 2 and verse 13 reads like this, "Be subject for the Lord's sake to every human institution." Now I want you to think about that for just a moment. When he says the Lord's sake, he's thinking about this. Who is it that saves us? Jesus Christ. If Jesus Christ is my Savior, if I've confessed Him as Lord, and I come along and I decide, well, I'm just going to disobey the government. I'm not going to listen to this. I'm not going to listen to that. When he says for the Lord's sake, he's saying, think of Jesus. He was subject to all the authorities, to all the law of Moses, to all the Roman authorities. He did everything he was asked to do. Did Jesus rebel? No, he did not. He went to the cross. But you might say, well, I'll have to suffer. Okay. Whoever said you wouldn't? In fact, the Bible tells us if we suffer for the name of Christian, we should glory in that. That if we live as a Christian, we not that we might suffer, but we will. 1 Peter chapter 2, verse 13. Think of the Lord, he says, and submit. Be subject for the Lord's sake to every human institution, whether it is to the emperor as supreme or to governors as sent by him to punish those who do evil and to praise those who do good. For this is the will of God, that by doing good you should put to silence the ignorance of foolish people. Live as people who are free, not using your freedom as a cover-up for evil, but as servants of God. Honor everyone, love the brotherhood, fear God, honor the emperor. That's a great last phrase. How should we treat each other? We should give honor and deference to our fellow Christians. We should submit to the government. We should do all those things, and we should love God. Those are things that Jesus and Paul both did in times of trial, in times that cost Jesus his life, and most certainly eventually cost Paul his. Well, finally tonight, I want to get into the actual reading of these two different trials. So if you would, turn to Luke chapter 23. We'll be there, and also to John 18, or Luke 23 first. And then we're going to actually read these trials, starting in Luke 23. And what has happened here, if you have a Bible, if you're familiar with the text, Pilate has already tried Jesus and found him to be blameless. But if you remember the setting of Jesus' death, it is the time of Passover. So at Passover, all the Jews have come to Jerusalem. Well, guess what? If I'm a Roman governor of Galilee, guess where I'm going to go to? I'm going to go to Jerusalem to be where the people are. So that is where Herod Antipas is. This is Herod Antipas from our chart. And in Luke chapter 23, it says this, verse 6. Luke 23 and verse 6. It says, "When Pilate heard this, he asked whether the man was a Galilean." The man here is Jesus. "And when he learned that he belonged to Herod's jurisdiction, he sent him over to Herod, who was himself in Jerusalem at that time." So what has happened here? This man, Pilate, is essentially following the legal protocol. He's got a man from Galilee. He can find nothing wrong with him. He has no reason to crucify him. He's ready to release him. He's got a crowd shouting, "Crucify him." And he's like, "Hey, I know. I'll let Herod deal with this." So he sends him to Herod. And what he may or may not have known is this is the same Herod who had beheaded John the Baptist. In fact, this same Herod, when he heard about the miracles Jesus was doing, said, "This must be John the Baptist raised from the dead." So he gets this opportunity, as far as he's concerned, to see this faith healer, to see this magician, to see this powerful teacher. But notice that Herod's response to Jesus is cynical and it is mocking. Verse 8 now, "When Herod saw Jesus, he was very glad, for he had long desired to see him because he had heard about him, and he was hoping to see some sign done by him. So he questioned him at some length, but he made no answer." Now that is Jesus there. So Herod questions Jesus, but Jesus makes no answer. "The chief priests and scribes stood by, vehemently accusing him, and Herod with his soldiers treated him with contempt and mocked him. Then arraying them in splendid clothing, he sent him back to Pilate. And Herod and Pilate became friends with each other after that very day, for before this they had been at enmity with each other. What was Herod's response to Jesus himself? It was mocking. Guess what the world's response to Jesus is today? If you were to ask a majority of Americans what they think about Jesus, is Jesus real? Do you believe Jesus was raised from the dead? Do you believe we should follow Jesus? Do you believe we should call things sin? Yes or no? Most people would laugh at that. Many would mock. Oh, you just believe in some flying spaghetti monster high in the sky, some God above the sky, some great father that's going to release you and all this kind of things that the atheists and those that don't believe in God will say to us. They don't say good things. As a majority is concerned, they're not very respectful of religious belief in this country. Time and time again, they're mocked. If you have a public display of religion, you're going to be mocked for it, almost certainly. Well, the same was true here with Jesus. Did Herod understand Jesus? No, almost certainly not. Jesus does not answer him, so he mocks him. And what we don't understand many times, we mock or we accuse. And that was the response of Herod to Jesus. I referred to it as a trial before Herod. Really, it was just a bringing, a mocking, and a scourging for Jesus. Notice also that the government officials, Pilate and Herod, are pleased with each other. That their co-hatred of Jesus, their co-dismissal of Jesus, gave them something around which to rally. So what's the response to the gospel? Many times it is mocking. I find Pilate's answer here very modern, very of today. Look at John 18 and verse 37. Many of you have heard me talk about what's called postmodernism, the idea of what is truth. And you know this phrase from Pilate here. But we live in a world that's decided what is morality. We'll decide that. You don't get to say what morality is. You don't get to say what history is. We'll just change all those things to suit ourselves. That's what's called postmodernism. The idea that there are no facts, that there's your truth. You may have heard that, right? There's your truth and my truth. There is no your truth and my truth. There is the truth of God. Now, I may think something is true, but if it doesn't align with the things of God, who has to change? Me. Pilate foreshadows this argument by 2,000 years. John 18, 37 and 38. John 18, verses 37 and 38. Oh, wait a minute, what have I got there? 37 and 38. My apologies, I've got it on the board wrong. It says, then Pilate said to him, so Pilate says to Jesus, so you are a king. Jesus answered, you say that I am a king. For this purpose I was born, and for this purpose I have come into the world, to bear witness to the truth. Everyone who is of the truth listens to my voice. You ever tried to tell somebody that you know the truth, that they need to believe the truth, that they need to know the truth, and the truth will set you free? That's what we do. That's what Jesus said to do. What's the world's response right now? You can't tell me what truth is. So, and likewise, Pilate says, what is truth? So the outside world may look at the gospel and they may mock it, or they may just dismiss it as a judgmental thing that is your opinion and not theirs. That's the world we live in. We live in a world that says there's no right or wrong, you just do what you want. We live in a world that makes fun of those who are Christian, that makes fun of those who allow Christian practice to overflow into their public life. And the third thing that we deal with is disbelief. Turn over to Acts chapter 26. In Acts chapter 26, we have the Roman official Festus. We also have another Roman official who fancies himself king of the Jews. Not necessarily king of the Jews, I wouldn't say, but king of Judea. And that is Herod Agrippa II. And Paul is appearing before them. Paul has been in jail for a couple of years now at this point. And he is finally dealing with someone he thinks will understand what he's talking about, because he's been talking to these Roman officials who have no background in Judaism. who don't understand why the Jews would be mad at him in the first place, and he's not getting anywhere. So now he has Herod Agrippa, and he also has his wife, who the Bible says is a Jewess. By the way, just historically, this is, I think it's the daughter of another Herod who is married to another brother at some time. It's complicated. I'm serious about this. If you have a good Bible dictionary or something like that, go look up the Herod entry. It'll be about four pages of confusion. So here we go. Paul is before these men, and he's going to present his conversion story. And notice how he takes the gospel, and he gets right after it. He is going to try to convert these men. Now, Paul is a prisoner. He's been there for several years. He literally is in chains. He's standing before a king. The Bible tells us comes in with pomp and circumstance. And he's standing before a Roman governor and a king, a tetrarch of an area. Paul's boldness here has always inspired me. Well, I think will to the day I die inspire me. Acts 26, and we'll start with verse 22. Acts 26 and verse 22. Paul here is talking about the fact that he saw Jesus on the road to Damascus. Jesus told him he must go to the Gentiles. That it gets us to verse 22. To this day I have had the help that comes from God, and so I stand here testifying both to small and great, saying nothing but what the prophets and Moses said would come to pass, that the Christ must suffer, that he, by being the first to rise from the dead, he will proclaim light both to our people and to the Gentiles. The first to rise from the dead. At this point, Festus bails out. At this point, he says, Paul, you've lost your mind. Literally is what he says. Verse 24, and as he was saying these things, as Paul was saying these things in his defense, Festus said with a loud voice, Paul, you're out of your mind. That's literally the words of God right there. Your great learning is driving you out of your mind. But Paul said, I am not out of my mind, most excellent Festus, but I am speaking true and rational words. So Festus, like those in Athens in Acts chapter 17, were able to listen to Paul until he said something about the resurrection from the dead. For the Jews, it was going to the Gentiles. For the Greeks, it was rising from the dead. In either case, they said, that's enough of listening to you, Paul. Now, Festus is basically leaving the proceeding here. But I want you to notice that Paul says, no, these are rational words. And then he turns and he sings an invitation song. This is Paul saying, why not tonight? He's going to come to this man before whom he's on trial, who he respects, who he submits to as a government official, who he is blameless before. And he goes after him hard. Listen to what he says. Verse 26 of Acts chapter 26. For the king knows about these things, and to him I speak boldly, for I am persuaded that none of these things has escaped his notice, for this has not been done in a corner. He's saying to Agrippa, you know Jesus rose from the dead. Festus says you're going out of your mind. Paul says to Agrippa, you know this is true. And because you know this is true, there are requirements, there are consequences. Verse 27, King Agrippa, do you believe the prophets? I know that you believe. You ever heard a preacher do that? You ever heard a preacher say, tonight's the night? I know that you're out there, I know you believe, and all you need to do is submit. Will you gain the whole world and lose your own soul? What Paul is doing here to the man before whom he's on trial. Paul continues. And Agrippa said to Paul, in a short time would you persuade me to be a Christian? Paul said, whether short or long, I would to God that not only you, but also all who hear me this day might become as I am, except for these chains. You know what Paul's saying? Agrippa says, you want me to be a Christian? He's saying, everyone in the building, man. Let's find the water. You don't baptize 3,000 people on the day of Pentecost unless you're that ready, unless you're that anxious, unless you're that filled with the Spirit of God, that there are those that need salvation, there are those that believe, and they stand condemned if they are not saved. That you're in better condition having been in a Roman jail for multiple years than the king of the area. And that if you had to trade places, that they would be better off to be as you are than as they are. when we're that convicted, when our response to the gospel is to preach it in that way, to be bold and to say to people, I know you believe, why won't you submit? Jesus did. We're told to. People should see Jesus' light in our life because we have cut away the things that are us. We've crucified the flesh and we let Jesus into our heart and we let Jesus shine. And we're not rude and we're not angry and we're not violent, we're not mean, we're not stealing, we're not cursing. We're loving and we're kind for the Lord's sake. And submissive one to another. That'll make people sit up and take notice. And when they do, don't be afraid to say, let's get you baptized. You need to become a Christian tonight. And whatever they say, you think Paul really cared what Agrippa was going to say there? No, he didn't care. Paul was there for one reason, and that was to make somebody a Christian. And he had a man who he knew believed the prophets, who knew about the resurrection, and that man needed to submit to Jesus Christ because it didn't matter if he was king of the world. He would have been better off to be the prisoner with Paul and to be saved and in Jesus Christ and forgiven. That's our lesson. We strive to be blameless. If anybody could have argued and said the government is unfair and tried to preach a doctrine of overthrowing the government, it would have been Jesus. It could have been Paul. These were men that were blameless, that submitted to the government, that preached the gospel, and despite the world's reaction to what was preached, they did the right thing and they tried to make others saved. Well, that's our whole goal here at the North Second Street Church of Christ. Seeking the lost and encouraging the saved. That's the total duty of this congregation. Bring them in and feed them. Bring them in and feed them. Bring them in, cleanse them in the waters of baptism. Cleanse the vessel so that the Spirit may dwell. Then build them up, encourage them, teach them, help them to mature. That's all we do. That's all we are. We're just simple Christians with a simple gospel and a simple church. If you're not a Christian, it's simple. Do you believe? Paul said, I know there's somebody out there that believes. I may not know your name tonight. I may not call you by name. But if you're out there and you believe, the response should be the same. In such a short time, do you want to make me a Christian? Yes. Short or long, I would pray that you would become as I am. If we can help you, come forward as we stand and we sing.